Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Ryan Lehrer on WNYC, and New York City Council Speaker Corey Johnson joins us now for his October visit to the show. He comes once a month, and we have a lot to talk about. The City Council just voted last week to close Rikers Island and replace it with four borough-based jails. Early voting starts for the first time ever in New York this Saturday, and one side of the ballot citywide are five groups of proposals from the City Council's Charter Revision Commission, including instituting ranked choice voting in citywide races, something election reform advocates are really excited about. And the Speaker has said the Council will vote on his city streets master plan this month. And as always, listeners, our lines are open to speak to the Speaker. Friday, we do Ask the Mayor. Once a month, we do Speak to the Speaker. Anything related to his work as New York City Council Speaker, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Welcome back.
Good morning, Brian. Nice to be here.
So when will Rikers Island be history?
Well, this week was, I think, a very big moment for the future of New York City, and Rikers Island has been a symbol of inhumanity and brutality. It has been a stain on New York City. It has been a place where people could go, a penal colony in the middle of the East River, where if you don't see it, you don't really have to think about it. And we've had this moment of criminal justice reform nationally, and we've had it here in New York City. I want to give credit to my predecessor, Speaker Mark Viverito, for appointing the Littman Commission and getting us to this point. But I think what you saw this past week was really a key moment in New York City's history. Four council members took a brave and courageous stand in the face of opposition to say we're okay with siting borough-based jail facilities. So ultimately, Rikers Island will
be in our district.
Yes, and Rikers Island will be closed and shuttered at the end of 2026. Hopefully, it's done before that when these new facilities are open. In 1990, we had 22,000 people incarcerated on Rikers Island at the height of the crack epidemic. 5 years ago, we had 11,000 people. Today, we have 7,000 people. And it's been going steadily down. Crime has gone down as well over the last 30 years. But this year and last year, we had the lowest number of homicides ever recorded. And you saw the criminal justice reform that was done at the state level on bail reform, speedy trial reform, and discovery reform. There's another key piece of legislation that I'm sure you'll cover this legislative session called the Less is More Act, which is people that are on probation or parole that have technical violations get sent back to Rikers Island. If they miss their curfew, they shouldn't be sent back to Rikers Island. So in the midst of all of this reform, we're doing something very big, finally shutting down a symbol of brutality and humanity. And I'm very proud of the City Council for getting this done.
Just on those members who voted for the borough jails in their districts, and the political courage that you're touting and the mayor touted here on Friday, there is some pushback that says it wasn't that courageous because these city council members, I think three of the four, are term limited. So they're not up for re-election anyway.
They're not up for re-election. Council members Levin, Kozlowitz, and Chin are term limited. But I think even with them, over the last 2 years, at any point they could have hit the exit ramp and said, you know, this is too much. There's too much opposition. We're not going to do this. And they saw this as a citywide issue. You heard Councilmember Chin say in her speech on the floor last week that her responsibilities as a council member do not end at the edge of Lower Manhattan, that she was working on the issues on White Street where the tombs currently are and how to try to mitigate the impact on the local community, but also knowing this is a key moment in our history. So I think they were brave, courageous, and I'm really proud of the work they did.
And I guess in fairness to them, even if you're term limited as a member of city council, a lot of people who find themselves in that position go on to try to get elected from the same district to something else, state legislature or whatever.
That's right.
Did the opposition to closing Rikers flip in the last year? Because I feel like the conversation when we started covering this to the conversation when this was passed last week changed from people who thought it would leave too few jail cells, law and order opposition, quote unquote, to people who think there will still be too many jail cells in the four borough jails, the No New Jails movement?
I think there was a combination of opposition on this. You had local neighborhood opposition who didn't want these facilities to be open in their district and they didn't want to live through the construction. You had people from the abolitionist side, the Nanu Jail side. You had people who said they thought we should just rebuild and rehabilitate the jails on Rikers Island. So there was a combination of those things that were happening throughout this process. But I think this is the right thing to do. You need to make sure, and this is where Rikers Island had a big flaw, besides the brutality and the consent decree and the U.S. attorney and the feds being involved and how bad Rikers has been. You need to get these people that are incarcerated close to the courthouses, and you need them close to their family members. Rikers Island didn't make that possible.
And maybe this is premature to even raise because the closure isn't until 2026. But I've heard various interesting proposals being explored for what to do next with Rikers Island, such as moving waste transfer stations there or new sources of green power like solar panels and maybe even new runways for LaGuardia. Is there anything in the works?
I haven't landed on a singular proposal, and I need to educate myself a little bit more. I've been so consumed with this, but I would say I really like the Green New Deal aspect of it, looking at what we could do. Could you do a wind farm? Could you do hydroelectricity? Are there things you could do on Rikers Island that could help power New York City in a more green way? And the one other thing I want to mention, Brian, which I think is a really important piece of this plan, this was not just about shutting Rikers Island down and opening up new jails. It was also about the holistic plan. So as part of the vote, and I think you mentioned this on Friday to the mayor, there was about $300 million in funding attached to this. And that funding was to fund people that have mental health issues who get incarcerated, restorative justice to help keep young people out, transitional beds and supportive housing, all of these things, violence interruption programs, all the things that we know work, enhanced supervised release, where a judge could say, we're not sending you to jail, we're going to have a release program for you. 95% of people who are on supervised release right now in New York City don't commit another felony. So we wanted to invest in all the programs which go to the root causes to try to end incarceration before it actually happens. It wasn't just about building new facilities. It was investing in the programs that we know will keep people diverted from jail and people who are in jail currently. How do you successfully reintegrate them back into life in New York City? That's what that money was set to go towards.
My guest is New York City Council Speaker Corey Johnson. We're going to go next to your streets master plan, quote unquote, to build more protected bike lanes and general shift the balance from cars to transit, bikes, and pedestrians. I gather there will be a vote on that this month, but I'm going to let two callers set this up, Mr. Speaker. First, Lee on Staten Island. Lee, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you for taking my call, Brian. Speaker Johnson, I'm disabled. I live on Staten Island, which means I have no subway. We already pay, as part of our bridge toll, a subsidy for the subways, which I don't have access to. I need my car to be able to get into Manhattan to see doctors. Why are you declaring war on me, on Staten Island, and on cars?
Lee, hang on. So that's Lee, and she speaks for a lot of people, I think. Then we have Andrea in Manhattan. Andrea, you're on WNYC. Hi.
And I want to thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I adore you, Mr. Johnson, for your fight against the car culture. And I totally accept that somebody like Lou should be given provisions to be able to do what she needs to do by any vehicle she needs to do it with, except it has to be mandated that all vehicles must be EVs. Our buses are EVs now. We have to have everything
electric
vehicles. And I want to thank you for supporting the 14th Street closure to cars so that public transport with electric vehicle buses can work, and I'm praying that you will also institute that on 42nd Street where I live and have 14 lanes of traffic polluting my lungs every day with poisonous toxic fumes and horrible noise pollution, and on every street in New York City. And anybody who needs vehicles to travel, like Lou, must be traveling in an electric vehicle. It has to happen now, later, now.
So Lee is still on. Lee, do you think you and Andrea could come to any kind of common ground and make the speaker's job really easy?
Sure, if she will pay her fair share of the tax that we pay for the bridge toll. I'm so sorry of paying for things I have no access to. First, we have to pay for the subways as part of the Verrazano bridge toll. Then we're going to have to pay I can't remember the name of it, but access to Midtown surcharge.
The congestion pricing.
Congestion pricing. So you're charging Staten Islanders twice. We're not getting any break on that. We have no subways, so we have an option that is not open to us that we are paying for everybody else, whereas the people who live in the other four boroughs, especially in Manhattan, can get to any subway they want to, go anywhere they want on one fare, and they're not paying what I'm paying that I don't even have access to. It's not fair, and I think it's unconstitutional. It's not equal rights.
Well, Lee, first of all, I want to thank you for calling in today, and I'm happy to hear different perspectives. Let me try to explain to you what I am seeking to do through this master plan bill, but also more holistically on transportation. You know, there are parts of the city, of course, that have better access to mass transit, like Manhattan, like parts of the Bronx, Brooklyn, and Queens, and Staten Island is a place that does not have the same level of mass transit investment that it really deserves to have. This is not about declaring war on cars. It's about trying to improve the entire city, because if we get cars off the road in Brooklyn and in Manhattan, it will make it easier for someone who must take a vehicle into Manhattan to get into Manhattan if there's less congestion. And the number one thing we need to do is we need to invest in and make mass transit reliable and safe for New Yorkers who could take the subway. You're saying you can't because you don't have it on Staten Island and you're disabled, so that's a double whammy. But for people that could abandon their cars and say, you know, the subway's working, the buses are moving, I'm not going to use my vehicle. If we had New Yorkers that did that, it would improve congestion for people that must use their cars, like you. There are transit deserts in New York City. You have South Brooklyn, you have Eastern Queens, you have Staten Island, you have parts of the North Bronx, you have places in the city where you don't have subway stations and where even the express buses are not operating on the schedule and in the time needed because of congestion throughout the entire city. And so this master plan seeks to help people that are pedestrians, cyclists, and people that use the bus. And if you do this in a holistic way, you will improve the entire system, the streets and the subways, for all people, so that individuals like you, Lee, who need to get into Manhattan or need to get into Brooklyn from Staten Island, it's going to improve your commute time. Now, the city council doesn't have any authority or say over what the cost is for the bridges, but I think what we can do is try to have a more sensible plan on how we move people around, and it's investing in mass transit so it's easier for people to get around. That will be the byproduct will be people that are going to still use private automobiles will have the ability to do so. And for Andrea, just quickly, sounds like she lives in Midtown on 42nd Street or near 42nd Street. I think the 14th Street busway is very exciting. I think we should look at it on 34th Street, on 42nd Street, on these major thoroughfares. We're going to have some data soon that Gridlock Sam Schwartz has been preparing for us. You're going to see some reports coming out in November that are going to look at those numbers. And I think the future of New York City is how we move people around. And also when we talk about the climate emergency that we're in, of transportation emissions, 83% of them are from private automobile use. This is an issue that we need to get right for future generations and just for the quality of life in New York City, to make it easy for New Yorkers to get around without having a headache every single day. So thank you, Lee. Thank you, Andrea. There is no war on you, Lee. It's supposed to make life better for everyone in New York City.
And thank you both calling in from me as well. One more thing on this. The folks who sued over the 14th Street closure, saying the neighborhood streets would be inundated with cars, meaning 15th Street, 16th Street, 13th Street, 12th Street, haven't dropped that claim. I've seen one study that found it not to be the case, however. I know it's early days, but where are those cars going that used to be on 14th Street? Because reportedly the congestion on the neighboring streets is not there.
Well, I want to say... I want to say, Brian, that I was skeptical, as I said on this show before, but I was wrong. You know, I thought that some of these streets were going to be parking lots. And the reason why I thought that is because 3 years ago, 17th Street between 7th and 8th Avenues was closed for almost 2 months because of a fire. And some of the surrounding blocks, when traffic got rerouted, were like parking lots during that time. I live on 15th Street between 7th and 8th Avenues. And there is a theory called induced demand. And induced demand says that if you change traffic routes, if you in Seattle, they tore a highway down that was carrying 90,000 people a day, and the area around that did not see an overwhelming crush of traffic. And it looks like the induced demand theory, but also fact, is coming into fruition. We're actually seeing it. We're going to have data to analyze. The MTA is already saying what a success this has been. The number of people have gone up on a weekly basis and on the weekends. So that is a really great thing. But we're going to look at this data and we're going to see how to actually improve it even more. 15% increase in ridership on weekdays. That's fantastic. People are calling it the miracle on 14th Street. When was the last time you heard anyone rave about getting on a bus and moving across town quickly? You could walk across town faster than taking the 14th Street crosstown bus in the past. So this is a raving success. It's something to build on and hopefully will be a model for other places in New York City, because again, to dovetail on what Lee said and what Andrea said, we need to move people around quickly and give people options so they don't have to use their private automobiles.
I want to go to the early voting, which is coming to New York this Saturday in advance of Election Day, and there is not much on the ballot. This year, it's a, quote, off-year election, no members of Congress, no city council, not the president, obviously, or governor. However, there is voting.
There's one city council race, District 45.
The open seat.
Yes.
From
in Brooklyn.
Jemani Williams?
Yes, District 45. That's the one seat on the ballot.
Yes, so that's kind of a special election on November 5th, and beginning this Saturday, October 26th, for early voting for the first time. So are we ready for early voting? There are other polling places set up around the city that are different from your usual polling place. There are fewer of them. So for most people, if they want to early vote, they have to seek this out. Is the city ready?
I hope so. You know, sadly, the Board of Elections is not controlled by the city, and we saw what happened a little more than a year ago in the September primaries in 2018, how what a mess it was that day on primary day. And so I hope that this is actually going to work out in the way we need it to. You know, initially, WNYC reported there were going to be 38 sites across the city. The Board of Elections increased that number to 61 sites, but it's a far cry from the 200 sites that the mayor proposed that we should have, and the administration offered money to try to help make that happen. $75 million in funds were put towards the early voting process. In a city of 8.5 million people, we need to make sure that voting is easily accessible, and we want to make sure that the distribution across the city is easy, that it's not a long distance, depending on where you live, to actually get to an early voting site. Voting's the cornerstone of our democracy, so I'm thrilled that for the first time ever, we're going to have the chance to have early voting. And for voters, you should have gotten in the mail your voter guide from the Campaign Finance Board. It's a nonpartisan guide. It should have on there what your early voting locations are. Unfortunately, you cannot vote at any early voting site in the city. You have to vote at the site you've been assigned to. So you have to look that up. If you don't vote early, you can still vote, of course, on election day, your assigned precinct. But I think this is very exciting, and I want people to turn out. Even though it's not a day where a lot of races are on the ballot, you do have the Charter Revision Commission proposals on the ballot, which is it's our city's constitution. And as you mentioned, ranked choice voting is on the ballot, and some other proposals related to police accountability and to the city's budget. So these are all important things. So we want people to turn out on November 5th and to turn out in early voting before that.
Let's go over a few of those five charter change proposals, because some of them are really big for the city. A lot of people will find these kind of mind-numbing and difficult to get their minds around, but I think we can explain them clearly. The station has already been doing this with our reporter Bridget Bergen, who's been doing such a great job on this show and elsewhere, but I think we need to do it a number of times between now and Election Day, because some of these things are a little bit complicated. But let's talk about ranked choice voting, which has some very vocal advocates, and it has some detractors, but it certainly has many vocal advocates. How would it work, and what's your position?
Well, my personal position, I'm not allowed to, as speaker, advocate. It's a little weird. Advocate on behalf of any of these ballot proposals. That's what the law says. But in my personal...
Because they came out of city council.
Exactly. My personal capacity, and I've always been a longstanding advocate and supporter of ranked choice voting. But the way ranked choice voting would work is that voters would actually have the choice to go into the ballot, to go into the voting booth and rank on their ballot candidates 1 through 5. So if you had 8 people running for city council, if you had 10 people running for mayor, you could go and you could say, Brian Lehrer is my first choice for the office, and my second choice is this person, and my third choice is this person.
Let me just make very clear that if nominated, I will not run, and if elected, I will not serve. But go ahead.
Thanks, Brian. And so it gives people an option, not a binary choice, and we think that could increase turnout, and it will eliminate the need to have a runoff 2 weeks later. In the past, for city council races, you could have 10 people running and someone could win with 18% of the vote because it was a plurality. This, you would actually reassign the votes and people would drop off, and you would actually count in second place votes as well as first place votes. They have this in San Francisco. They have this in Minneapolis. They have this in the entire state of Maine. It's been very successful. I think voters like actually having a choice. It results in a more positive campaign where you want to appeal to more people. You have to go to more places throughout the city if you're running citywide, and that is why you've seen such enthusiasm for ranked choice voting. I think it's a great thing for New York City.
And we should say, if you run for mayor, which a lot of people think you will, I don't know if you've formally announced or anything like that in 2021, you might be one of the first to see how it actually works. Were you saying in that last answer that you think it would make you campaign differently than if we didn't have ranked choice voting?
I think you're going to have to, for anyone who's running citywide, anyone who's running borough-wide, because this would be the borough presidents as well, anyone running in a city council district, you're going to have to go to more places, or you should probably should go to more places, because you're going to want to meet more people, because you're going to want to be people's not just potential first choice, but second choice as well. So that's going to mean that if there's a constituency you may think you may not appeal to as their first choice, you may want to go and try to become their second choice. So I think it is going to change things a little bit. And that's a good thing, because people are going to hear more points of view and you're going to go to more places in the city. And we saw this successfully done in other major cities and in the state of Maine last year.
We have a call with pushback to ranked choice voting. So let's take it. Robert on the Upper West Side. Hi, Robert. You're on WNYC.
Hello. So I'm a visitor. I live in Burlington, Vermont. And 10 years ago in 2009, and Burlington is no conservative city, we had ranked choice
Bernie
voting.
Sanders
we had the name
the
of it called instant runoff voting, but it's essentially exactly the same method that you're describing, where you eliminate the bottom candidate based solely on the count of their first choice votes or the promoted first choice votes. In that election, we actually elected a candidate when more of the city voters preferred specifically another candidate for that. The candidate that the city voters preferred what came in third in the instant runoff count. He didn't have enough votes to get into the final round, but had he had enough votes, or had he gotten into the final round, he would have defeated any candidate in the final round. So, in effect, the rule that you want to have is if more voters prefer candidate A over candidate B than the number of voters for the contrary, you don't want to elect candidate B. But what happened in Burlington, Vermont, we did end up electing candidate B, even though more voters marked their ballots that they preferred candidate A over candidate B. As a result, the next year in 2010, instant runoff voting was repealed. Hmm. And so that's a warning. Mm-hmm. I am no...
In your opinion, Robert, is it a warning to do it right, or is it a warning to not do it at all? Because
no,
you can't do it right.
To do it right. Don't listen to Fair Vote and how to do it. use what's called the Condorcet method. It's named after a French mathematician from 200 years ago, C-O-N-D-O-R-C-E-T. That's the way that you should do ranked choice voting anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. And it's too late for this ballot proposal because it's already written and sealed. It'll be up or down on the way you described it. But what's your reaction to Robert? Did you look at Burlington before this went through?
Well, you mentioned it, Brian. Bernie Sanders, the former mayor of Burlington, Vermont. So Burlington, Vermont is a great hotbed of progressive politics in America. You know, I wasn't involved in the drafting of these questions. The council passed a law which created the Charter Revision Commission, and it had appointees from the mayor, the comptroller, the public advocate, the five borough presidents, and the city council. And this was done in a consensus-driven way. And so I wasn't involved in exactly how they were determining whether it was the Condor method, which I'm going to look up now, versus another type of method.
Condorcet.
Condorcet.
Yeah.
And so I think that we want to make sure this is done correctly. We want to educate voters on how it actually works. You're going to have a couple of years to do that between if this gets approved and when people are going to actually start using it. And so we're going to look at all that and hopefully do enough education to get people the information they need to make an educated way of handling this.
We just have we have 2 minutes left. Let's see if we can do one more of the five for today. There's changes to the Civilian Complaint Review Board, which monitors the police department. There are changes to how the city budget would have to work or would be allowed to work. There's one on ethics, like lengthening the amount of time before an elected official can lobby. The one I want to ask you about before you go is land use, because that's always, of course, so controversial in the city, when and where things can be developed. What would change with land use under this charter revision proposal?
I'm not remembering the exact ballot question because there are so many questions on the ballot. There are five groupings.
I think it's to give borough presidents and community boards more information and slightly more power in the process.
Yeah, so there's a phase currently when applications are being certified called the pre-certification phase. And when an application gets certified to go through the land use process, that's when it goes to the community board first, then the borough president, then the city planning commission, then the city council. But in that phase before it gets certified, there is a back and forth that's going on between the applicant and the Department of City Planning. And so this proposal is to give community boards a seat at the table and borough presidents earlier on so that they're not getting the application right when it's proposed, right when it's certified, but actually it gives them a seat at the table to understand why things are happening during pre-certification. It's a transparency method. I think it's a good thing. I was chair of a community board before I ran for the city council. I was on the land use committee of that community board. And so we were always getting information at the last minute. So I think anything we can do to give a little bit more time to these community boards is a good thing. And there's also something that looks at the summer months as well on these land use applications and community boards, I think, in the proposal.
All right. We'll keep explaining the other charter revision proposals as the voting comes closer. And of course, we will continue to speak to the speaker, New York City Council Speaker Corey Johnson. Thank you as always.
Brian, I just want to say lastly, in Andy Byford, we trust. I saw the reports this past week. Mm-hmm. I am so glad he rescinded his resignation.
This is the Transit
letter.
Authority president,
yes,
who I think felt marginalized by Governor Cuomo, even though most people think he's doing a really good job at getting the subways toward back to where they had been. And yes, and he resigned and then rescinded his resignation.
It would be a major, major, major loss for New York City to have Andy Byford leave. He has done such an incredible job since January of 2018 when he started. You've seen significant improvements that he got since he got there. You saw a huge capital plan that the MTA voted on earlier this month. This is he is just a real amazing leader that we attracted to New York City, and I want him to stay. It would be a real shame if he lost, so I hope that's one of the presidential candidates will pick him as their running mate. I'm joking. I don't want to lose him, but that shows you how much confidence I have in Andy Byford. I think he's great, and I'm glad that he rescinded that letter. We need him staying on. I want to thank you, as always, for having me today.
Do you have any reason to think that the governor backed down on any particular thing that caused Andy Byford to rescind his resignation?
I have no idea how this actually came to be or what happened. I did read reports that he and the governor had actually been working together and collaborating and getting along in the last few months. I read a story on that about a month ago, so I have no idea what led to this, but he's doing a great job. We need him to stay on. And Andy, if you're listening, keep up the great work.
Mr. Speaker, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Brian.